This episode of AHLA Speaking of Health Law is brought to you by AHLA members and donors like you. For more information, visit AmericanHealthLaw.org.
Hi, and welcome to AHLA's Speaking of Health Law podcast. I am Kate Heffernan. I'm a member at the law firm of Epstein, Becker & Green in our Boston office. And I'm joined here today by my colleague and friend, Elizabeth McAvoy. Elizabeth, do you want to introduce yourself?
Yes. Good afternoon, Kate, and good afternoon to everyone. My name is Elizabeth McAvoy. I am a partner at Hinckley Allen & Snyder in our Boston office, and I'm also the chair of our Research Compliance and Integrity Group. And we are thrilled to talk today a little bit today about not just health law, but also all things research integrity.
And I had the pleasure of presenting in February with Elizabeth at the AHLA Advising Providers Program in New Orleans, where we were able to speak with some of our colleagues about the research misconduct regulations. So we're here today just to have another more informal conversation about research misconduct and how we regulate it here in the United States. So let's start with some basic concepts just to level set and make sure everyone is aware of what we're even discussing today. Can you give us a little bit of background, Elizabeth, about what research integrity really is and what that is in the law as opposed to, say, research compliance more broadly?
Yes, I think this is a critical distinction and truly kind of a baseline for anyone that's going to be discussing research misconduct. Research integrity is really kind of focused on the data. So research misconduct and research integrity are terms of art. They're really talking about the reliability, accuracy, and really kind of the scientific value and scientific principles behind the data. So it is very tied to the scientific exercise and, you know, behind the data. Whereas when we think of research compliance, what we're really saying there, and I think as a side note, most people are more familiar with the word compliance. Compliance is really often used and paired with whether research is complying, that is adhering to federal requirements, institutional requirements, and potentially other funding requirements and how it's carried out. So, you know, research compliance, I like to think of it as a big umbrella of the way we should do research. But when we talk about research integrity, we're cutting out a slightly different slice of that. We're saying, you know, is the research itself kind of progressing in a way that it's reputable, that it's accurate, that it's reliable? So it is a truly kind of unique vantage point when we look at research and you know, when we look at what is valuable to those that are going to be using the byproducts of that research.
That's so interesting. And you note, you know, this really is kind of focused on the science, right? It's about the data. It's about the reliability and the accuracy of those data. So can you explain a little bit, you know, why we even need laws in this area? Why isn't this just a matter for science to govern itself?
I think that's a really great observation. And I'm sure there's plenty of scientists and others out there who kind of have asked this same question. Like, how do these areas lend themselves to legal oversight? I think the reality is, you know, unlike research compliance, where we're really kind of looking at everything, this is an area that for a long time, just going back historically, didn't have oversight. And what happened is there were serious concerns raised about 20 plus years ago about how the academic research world was progressing and how valuable the output was that these scholarly papers and these projects were really producing. And I think it led to some real concern on both the congressional and federal level as well. It's kind of in the industry, in the you know, industry of those conducting the research, about how do we police, how do we ensure that when people are publishing results, when they are holding out data, that it's something that we can rely on and we don't have to kind of worry and second guess ourselves. And, you know, how can we progress science, right, at that fundamental level? And that really led itself to kind of coming up with a framework for what is required. And the way that framework really is handed down is through the oversight agencies and through the institutions. And I won't get too much into the details of the fundamentals of the process, but, you know, the way that the matters of science really come about as a legal matter is that each funding agency, for the most part, and each institution that receives those funds to perform research, have a set of requirements that they have to follow to make sure that they're supporting responsible research and to ensure that the research is meeting basic criteria that are not affected by fabrication, falsification, and plagiarism, the quote FFP, which really defines research misconduct. And the reason it's a legal issue, getting back to your question, Kate, is because, we need to have, I think this goes back to kind of government in general. This is a way that our government has said they're going to continue to support the advancement of science, but only in a responsible way. So these are conditions that the government essentially has kind of imposed through the mechanism it has available, its oversight agencies like NIH, like NSF, and others. And it's really, I think, a merging of two worlds, and it's been quite rocky over the course of history. And I think it often is something that can be really difficult for lawyers to deal with and for scientists to deal with because it is unique in that respect.
And you raise a great point that I think it bears pausing on, which is that, the nexus for the true legal requirements does come from the federal dollars that support the research, right? So our government, as you noted, seeks to support the progression of science with money that it grants to institutions to support scientists' work. And it is through those funding terms and through the connection to the funding dollars that the government can impose these requirements. That said, I think it's fair to say that in light of that floor of requirements that the government has set forth, we see most institutions applying through policy the same types of standards to all of its research, regardless of funding.
Yeah, I think that's right. And, just to kind of expand, I think one thing that's interesting to talk about, Kate, maybe you can kind of chime in here, is these institutional policies and kind of how the institutions who are directly involved in a lot of the research that we're talking about here, what they have today in 2024 in their books is very different, and how they approach research integrity is very different than it has been. As I mentioned, kind of historically, there wasn't even federal oversight. What are some of kind of the trends and differences you've seen in your practice as these research integrity matters have gained more and more traction?
That's a great question. And it talk about a rocky road. It really has evolved and changed dramatically since I started being involved in these types of matters. It has been about 20 years now. So, what we used to see, and I think what the law that, was put into place around 2000 and then in 2005 on the Department of Health and Human Services side, is really an internal faculty scientist to scientist peer review process that is guided by the law. So, I think originally the regulations that the government had put forward, which again started with a federal policy put out by the Office of Science and Technology and then was adopted in a variety of forms by the different funding agencies. We really saw a deference, I think, to scientific peer review and to an approach that allowed for scientists and the institutions at which they work to manage concerns as they were raised internally, for the most part, around research that had been performed with federal money and whether or not there were concerns that rose to the level of research misconduct. And again, as Elizabeth pointed out, research misconduct itself is a very specific and specifically defined type of concern. It's not misconduct writ large. It's not just bad behavior. It's not just acting in a way that may suggest sloppiness in one's approach to science. It's very specific. It is falsification of data, fabrication of data, or plagiarism. And all of those three things have to do very specifically with how one is representing the output of research experimentation in the scientific research record and in the scientific literature. And so originally it was sort of an in-house type of process where there were, as a general matter, faculty panels that looked at the concerns that were raised. The regulations, provided a framework and a prescriptive one at that, but still a framework within which those proceedings tended to play themselves out. And there were, reporting requirements to the government, but again, there was a lot of deference given, I think, to the institutions and how the institutions managed those processes in the first, sort of 10 to 15 years of how we saw the law implemented. I think what we've seen in recent years, and it's been a really interesting development, is a much more public undertaking of the vetting of these concerns. So, in addition to online peer review websites such as PubPeer and others, where the intent of these online resources was to allow for scientists to exchange information and feedback on published papers and on published results. Again, in the furtherance of the scientific process, we have seen sort of a move from that to a public allegation platform where those types of websites, as well as Twitter, as well as blogs and other types of very public spaces, are being used by individuals to allege claims of research misconduct. So not just that there may be questions about a paper, but that the implication is that those questions arise from a scientist's ill intent, and there's a purposefulness behind the concerns that have been identified. And that has really changed the way in which I think institutions are forced to grapple with these proceedings, because before you're even beginning to digest as an institution what the concerns are and whether they are ones that under the law need to be reviewed and need to be addressed, you're usually already dealing with media inquiries related to, very public airings of those concerns.
It's really interesting what you just mentioned about kind of the public nature and how the shift really went from in-house internal matters, largely handled by scientists, right? Less kind of legal in nature originally. And now they're, full-blown institutional matters involving PR. And there's a lot of, I think, non-traditional players who are weighing in, even if it's informally, on kind of what it means for the institution. And I think, certainly putting the matter of misconduct really out there for public consumption, like something that's never really previously been out there.
Yeah, I agree. And it's not just the institutions, I think, that are feeling that public pressure. I mean, I think the Office of Research Integrity, which is the office within the Department of Health and Human Services that enforces the regulations for PHS funded research. I mean, my impression is they feel that same pressure. They are also under scrutiny as to, the time in which it takes to review these matters, the speed in which actions may be taken against scientists. And so, again, whereas you used to have maybe a final reporting obligation out to the government, and they would at that point decide whether additional federal action might be necessary, we're now seeing a much earlier involvement of ORI and other federal funding agencies when concerns get raised, because they're well aware of them, again, because of the public nature.
Right. And that early involvement, just to kind of segue into this larger picture, right? We're talking about health law, and many of you may be listening have a legal backgrounds or partner with legal professionals and your pursuits. And I think this is part of the touch points where these matters, even though they deal primarily with science and the integrity of science, become legal concerns for both the stakeholders at institutions, for the individuals involved. And I think to put a finer point on what Kate was just kind of highlighting for everyone, it really has raised the stakes for institutions and for individuals to be under such scrutiny and to be looking at this as kind of an area of government oversight or government enforcement, which is a lens that I don't think prior, to maybe 7, 8 years ago, a lot of individuals in academic science would have, subscribe to. I think it seemed for a long time that kind of science could progress on the science alone and on the novelty of the science and of the impact of the underlying findings. And all of a sudden, kind of this area that has, been autonomous is now one of the many highly regulated areas that the government, by virtue of ORI and by virtue of NIH, OIG, and others, is really focusing on. And I think it brings an incredible new lens and a lot of additional pressures and responsibility to both the institutions that are overseeing it and guiding the research, as well as the individuals carrying out that research on every level, from a principal investigator to, a senior scientist, to postdoc, all the way to junior trainees who are wading into this new profession. And each one has a responsibility and with incredible scrutiny at every stage. So, I think this becomes a challenging environment to perform academic science, and yet, the need for advances is always there. And I think, certainly still very important to the institutions that support science.
It's such an important point, and it circles back to one you made earlier, just about this, kind of increasing tension between the scientific pursuit and the regulation of it. I've heard repeatedly, from scientists at institutions who grapple with the way in which these proceedings unfold. We're entering into an era where scientists are going to be afraid to make mistakes. They're going to be afraid to fail forward, which is such, a critical principle in their, from their perspective to the scientific endeavor. The number of times you need to make mistakes and go the wrong direction with science for you to end up at a moment of true discovery, is a refrain that I hear over and over, from the scientists who are concerned that the hyper-regulation of this area is going to have a terribly chilling effect on junior scientists in particular, who really need to know that that is sort of part of the scientific endeavor. And when I think scientists see, every single, what they perceive as every single mistake and error and correction, being highlighted in online publications as, a potential indication of malfeasance, that raises some, I think, legitimate concerns from their perspective as far as how does failure and mistakes and the ability to have your work questioned, which again is part of the traditional scientific peer review process, become in some ways cabined by the concerns around integrity. And then I think on the other hand, you see, legitimate concerns by the government that they don't want to be funding work where, reproducibility is truly in question and where there are concerns that that falsification has occurred, because obviously that's not why the government puts money towards the scientific endeavor. They want to fund research that, meets the highest standards of ethics and integrity. But I think we are sort of at this crossroads where, we are seeing proposed changes in the regulations, and I know we want to segue to that, in a moment. We have a lot of these unanswered questions within the regulated community and within the scientific community about what is the best way to protect the integrity of the scientific enterprise from a legal standpoint.
Yeah, I do. I agree completely. The crossroads, has certainly presented itself. And, I think there's a lot of really valid questions being raised about what research looks like 10, 15, or even 20 years from now, given the current environment. And just to kind of circle back to something Kate just mentioned, when we talk about the risks and regulation that the government pursues of academic science, there's of course kind of the interactive internet litigating matters through Papeer and other forums. And then, just generally the institutional proceedings, which we talked about. There's also some, a real shift, I think, across the country in the law enforcement in the Department of Justice, as well as aided by the various offices of Inspector General, To looking at some of the larger instances of substantiated misconduct as false claims. So when we talk about kind of why the government is concerned, we're really focusing on another form of what the government views as fraud and abuse, because they're funding a program, through the various funding agencies, and often at the hundreds of millions of dollar level. And when there are substantiated findings that the outcome is essentially waste and that it's not usable for scientific advancement, there is a couple of valid, legal theories that can be applied. And the government, with increasing frequency, is looking at these, like other types of kind of health law fraud cases that, under the False Claims Act, looking at these kind of as civil as well as criminal violations. And really, the theory is not new or novel, but it is new and novel that the government would look at science in this way when it doesn't involve, patient harm or pharmaceuticals or, something more typical when we think of, fraud and abuse in health law. So, it's really the stakes have never been higher, as we've said, and that's been borne out by various legal proceedings across the country and a lot here in Boston as well. So let's talk about the new rules, Kate, because I think this is, you mentioned 2005 was the last time that the Public Health Service, set the official kind of regulatory framework. And here we are, almost 20 years later, talking about potential new framework and how everyone involved has to carry out the oversight of research integrity and specifically ferret out misconduct. So, what are the kind of changes on a broad level? What impact are they going to have? And who's subject to these potential new changes?
Right. So yeah, I mean, I love living through a moment of major regulatory change, as do most health lawyers. So it is exciting. We haven't, seen major changes to this framework in quite some time. And again, I think, the question's going to be, how does this new era of regulation serve, all the stakeholders that you mentioned earlier? How does it serve the institutions? How does it serve the government? How does it serve the scientists? How does it serve the funding agencies? So I think all of those, questions are still, to be seen. We have proposed rules, as you noted. They cover a number of changes. And I think, when we knew this was, kind of on the horizon, but I think people weren't entirely sure, what the scope of the proposed revisions would involve. And some of the proposed changes were, as expected, and others I think were, surprising to the regulated community. I will note that the proposed rule generated, a pretty significant response from the regulated community. There were a number of comments submitted to the government in response to the proposed rule. So it remains to be seen which of those, have any impact on the final rule, if they have any impact at all. And I think, we're operating under the assumption there may be a final rule as early as this summer. So that will be really interesting to see. I will note, just to kind of cover some of the higher changes that we've been looking at, and expect to see, some form of in the final rule. There's a number of, new definitions that didn't exist in the 2005 current regulation, and they've been definitions that I think have been, part of some of the challenges that institutions reviewing these matters have encountered. For example, what does it really mean to act in a reckless manner? So as we've sort of noted in passing throughout today's conversation, in order to for something to really be misconduct, there has to be an intentionality to it, but it's not limited to acting intentionally. You can also act recklessly under the regulations, and you can act knowingly. And until the proposed regulation, we really didn't have definitions as to what those words mean. And in particular, the term reckless has been one that's been a subject of court cases and a subject of a lot of conversation amongst the regulated community because it is so close to that line of what it means to perhaps simply be acting, in a scientifically sloppy way or just sort of doing bad science that isn't necessarily intentional fraud. So there has been a proposed definition for recklessness put forward, and that was, hotly debated as part of the comments that were submitted in response. There are other additional types of changes with respect to sort of at what point the government gets involved in these matters. As I noted earlier, again, until recently, where there's been this greater public scrutiny and public publication, really, of these allegations, the government enforcement office really wasn't involved until pretty far down the line in one of these proceedings. So there's several steps to the process, and you really didn't start to engage with the government until you were kind of halfway through, to be fair. And now we've seen earlier engagement in part because of just awareness. And I think with the proposed regulations, what we see the government seeking to do is really to formalize that, to put the government, sort of much more in touch with institutions and much more involved in terms of their input at an earlier stage in the process. And again, there are different views on whether that's a good thing or might itself chill, some of the earlier airing of concerns within institutions, but a pretty significant procedural change that's part of the proposed regulation.
Yeah, I think the involvement of regulators and just kind of that regulatory oversight, it seems to kind of be trending towards, greater and greater involvement. And that will obviously really shift how everyone in the community views research misconduct. Another, I know we're kind of nearing the end of our time, but I thought another interesting point for the proposed regulations moving forward is around kind of confidentiality. Because as we've been talking about today, historically, what's been interesting for those of us that, practice in the area of research misconduct has been how it's become a very discrete, science-based, peer review-based issue, and it's turned into a more kind of systemic, institution-wide matter of concern that is litigated out in the public, often through the internet. And not only have kind of regulators become more and more interested and involved, but now there's this kind of really about face in how the institutional work is potentially shared beyond the institution. So, we haven't gotten into a lot of the nuts and bolts, but one thing that has always been, I think, comforting from my perspective for scientists is that, if they carry out the process and the institution at the end of the institutional process, does not find misconduct, there is, the matter closes with the institution and the confidentiality will kind of remain around those proceedings. And now there is kind of a very radical proposal that institutions have to report out their activity and their findings to ORI to be publicly shared in the spirit of transparency. And I think that has a lot of concerns raised in the community about what that would mean for how, again, going back to the fundamental point we're at, how can we conduct science when the stakes seem so high?
I agree. I think you summarize it perfectly, which is, we just have two competing interests here. We have the interest of science continuing and there not being a chilling effect, and we have the interest of the institutions carrying this out appropriately and ensuring that they're monitoring their scientists appropriately. And we have the government, wanting to exert their oversight, understandably, but all of those three things, it's challenging to balance them appropriately to ensure that we're meeting all the right aims.
Yes. So, I think we just scratched the surface here today of some really, interesting, incredibly nuanced issues in the matter, in the sphere of research misconduct and research integrity. But as we highlighted today, certainly lots more to come, and potentially a huge kind of new wave of regulatory enforcement that stands to be seen as early as this summer. So thank you so much to everyone for tuning in. Thank you, Kate, for a great conversation this afternoon.
Thanks
And
to you too.
have a great day, everybody.
Take care.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, be sure to subscribe to AHLA Speaking of Health Law wherever you get your podcasts. To learn more about AHLA and the educational resources available to the health law community, visit AmericanHealthLaw.org.